Buying or selling your home? Real Estate for Life can connect you with a pro-life real estate agent. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 65% to Catholic Answers. Learn more at realestateforlife.org. Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Finishing strong this week. We got Jimmy Akin this hour. Ask me anything. 888-318-7884. And Jimmy's here. I think people know this. I don't even say it anymore usually. You can really ask anything. Whatever you'd like to know, you are welcome to call. Jimmy, of course, the proprietor of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. Now the Jimmy Akin podcast also appears on a bunch of other podcasts, including this one. I think the total regular appearances is six. Jimmy, is that right? Total regular. Yep. Six different podcasts. But how many of them can people just pick up the phone and call you? How many of them are like that? Just this one? It's just this one?
Yeah, this is the only normal live call-in show, yeah.
Yeah, so your chance to call Jimmy Akin, 888-318-7884. But as I said, all the lines are full, so we'll just put Jimmy right back to work. We'll go up to Alberta, Canada, where Catherine, enjoying the balmy winter weather of Canada, I am sure, watching on YouTube. Welcome, Catherine.
Hi.
Hi, Catherine.
My question is, of course, for Jimmy Akin. We had a discussion over email a few weeks ago about my situation with my family member, but I know you are insanely busy, so I will just get right to it. So as I mentioned in that email, a family member of mine who has been a devoted lifelong Catholic has now joined the Congregation of Mary Immaculate Queen, which is essentially Sedevacantism. So he's now convinced that the church you and I attend every Sunday is the false church or the conciliar church, and he alone is a part of the true Catholic church. His main and the heart of his reason for making this big decision is he believes that Saint Pope John Paul II was falsely canonized after he believes he encouraged and allowed pagan worship at Assisi. His specific allegations are that Jewish attendees were granted a request to worship in a room that had not been blessed in the name of our Lord Jesus Christ. And another example was that Buddhist idols were allowed and worshipped, and that even Saint Pope John Paul II bowed before these idols. So his main issue is that there was no clarification on the evils of paganism, and that even the Assisi event was renewed after the fact. So I really want to bring him back to the church. How can I respond to his arguments?
Okay, well, the first one is I would want to see primary source documentation for each of the claims he's made. How do you know that these events ever happened? And how do you know, even if they did happen, that John Paul II authorized them as opposed to some Vatican apparatchik way down in the hierarchy? Because the Pope does not go over the plans for every little detail of what happens at an event. You know, he doesn't review it all personally and then give his approval or disapproval. Popes are way too busy for that. So they have lower down assistants who do that kind of stuff. So not only do you need to show that these events actually happened, you need to show that he himself approved them. And I'm very sure that he won't be able to provide primary source documentation as opposed to just claims, often claims made on some internet site, that these were the case. I'm just really sure that he will not be able to provide that. And given that, then we owe him the benefit of any doubt. You know, St. Paul says, reckon others better than yourselves. And if you read in the Catechism, it talks about how in cases of doubt, you have to give the benefit of the doubt as a form of proper respect to another human being. And that's all the more the case when it's the Pope, who deserves extra respect. I'm also very sure the Pope did not worship Buddhist statues. If he did, where's the photos? You know, show us the photos of that happening. And merely bending at your waist you know, when there happen to be Buddhist statues in the room does not mean you were worshiping them. He might be bowing to, for example, a person that is standing near them, because bowing is a customary form of greeting in many East Asian cultures. So you've got to look at the any evidence that gets presented and consider carefully what could be going on in these situations. Then there's a third thing that would need to, I mean, if his claim is really that it was the canonization of John Paul II that that caused the church to fall into error and cease to be the true church, then you'd have to look at that canonization and say, what are the implications of it? Is that even meant to be infallible? Because if it's not meant to be infallible, and there are various theologians like Cardinal Avery Dulles, for one, and myself for another, who would argue that saint canonizations are not infallible, then canonizing him is not going to have, is not protected by infallibility, and therefore it would not falsify the church. It'd just be a mistake, even if all that were true. Then there's the fact that even if these events happened, and even if John Paul II approved them, well, that would mean that he made mistakes. But you know what is great about being Christian? Cy Kellett, if you're a Christian and you make mistakes, what can happen?
I could get forgiven by somebody.
Yeah,
that might happen.
Who would want to do the forgiving here?
Well, I mean, I suppose the person I offended, ultimately, but God will always always ready to forgive. Yeah.
So if you are a Christian, even a Pope, and you make mistakes and you repent, God's going to forgive you. And certainly we saw that happen with the very first Pope, with St. Peter, who actually denied Christ, which is worse than anything that your brother is alleging John Paul II did, you know, actually denying Christ. And in Mark, it even says Peter began to curse. And there are significant reasons that some biblical scholars think he may have been cursing Jesus to demonstrate that he wasn't a follower of Jesus. And that's way worse than anything John Paul II is alleged to have done, and yet Peter got forgiven and went on to be a valid pope. So your brother is applying standards that, A, he hasn't properly vetted these claims, and B, he's applying standards that are not reasonable, that don't take into account other biblical principles, like giving people the benefit of the doubt, or people who've made mistakes being forgiven, or, you know, so forth. So basically all the stuff I just covered. There's a lot more to know about church teaching and how it works. And since you're in North America, although barely, since you're in Canada, we should be able to send you a copy of Teaching with Authority. So if you'll hang on the line, we'll get you a copy of that, and you can read up to learn more about how to deal with challenges like this and how the church's teaching authority actually works.
Thanks, Catherine. I'm going to keep going and let Jimmy answer more questions because all the lines are full. Off to Baltimore, Maryland we go. Tom, watching on YouTube. Welcome, Tom. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Yes. Hello. I was wondering why in some Catholic Bibles, the Maccabees chapters are at the very end of the Old Testament, while in others they're in the middle. As far as I know, the Maccabean revolt in Antiochus were 2nd century before Christ. Mm-hmm. Makes sense to have it at the end, but what's the discrepancies there?
Well, there is no divinely inspired table of contents, and so you find the books of the Bible in different orders in different Bibles. That applies not just to, now these days we have a pretty much universal placement of the New Testament books, but that hadn't always been the case. You know, today the Gospels are typically presented in the order Matthew, Mark, Luke. But if you go back and read Christian Bibles from earlier in history, you'll find them in different orders. Like you'll have Matthew, John, Mark, Luke, or things like that. And we still have that to some degree with the Old Testament. Some Old Testaments put the Maccabees at the end, so that because they're dealing with a historical period that is closest to the New Testament. On the other hand, some want to keep all of the historical books together, and so they place them earlier, after Ezra and Nehemiah. because they are, like Ezra and Nehemiah, they're historical books, and so they keep them with the other historical books, and then they go off into the wisdom literature and then into the prophetic books. So it's really up to the Bible publishers to decide how do they want to structure things.
All right.
No problem.
Tom, you know what? Since you asked a Bible question, I haven't given away Jimmy's book, The Bible is a Catholic Book, for a while. So why don't you hang on the line and we'll send you, we're happy to send to Baltimore a copy of The Bible is a Catholic Book. That'll take me to the break, actually. We better take a break. We'll be right back with more Ask Me Anything with Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live.
Miss a show? Make sure to catch up by downloading the podcast, available online at Catholic.com.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Magnificat. Published monthly, Magnificat features texts of daily mass, prayers, articles, meditations, art commentaries, and more, in step with the liturgical rhythm of the Church, on the web at magnificat.com.
Catechism in a Year with me, Father Mike Schmitz, is now available right here on Catholic Radio. Encounter God's plan of sheer goodness for us, revealed in Scripture and passed down through the tradition of the Catholic faith, as we journey together toward our heavenly home.
Bible in a Year and Catechism in a Year with Father Mike Schmitz, tonight at 10 p.m. Eastern, 7 p.m. Pacific, on EWTN Radio.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Having fun on a Friday here. It feels festive because Edgar put up the decorations. We've got the stockings up. We've got that something, beads of some sort up. Not exactly sure. Two Christmas trees of the Charlie Brown variety. And we've got guests in studio with us. Jimmy Akin is our guest both hours today, and it's an Ask Me Anything. And in studio, we have students from the Our Lady of Mount Carmel homeschooling group, and now we have Emmanuel in studio with us. Hello, Emmanuel.
Hi.
And what year are you in school, Emmanuel?
I'm in freshman, and I'm in ninth grade.
All right. You are in ninth grade. Well, we're happy to have you here. You have a question for Mr. Akin?
Yeah.
All right, right up to the microphone there and go ahead and ask your question.
It says in Genesis that God's presence dwelled in the Garden of Eden, and since marriage or sex is the manifestation of our desire to be in union with God, then why did Adam yearn for a partner, Eve?
Because God designed him to have one. And so he wanted a human race, and that means that, and he designed us as sexual beings, so it takes both a man and a woman to have a baby, and he wanted them to have babies, and so he built the desire for a partner into Adam. And because human babies are born, because of how smart we are, we need to be born with really big heads, then because we're bipeds, we walk upright. The babies need to be born when they're immature enough that their giant heads can still fit through the birth canal. And that means they have to be born very prematurely compared to other species. And that means that the parents need to stay together for decades to raise them to adulthood. So that's why we have permanent marriages as humans. And so that means we're here to help each other out, because you need to, if you want the parents to stay together, they need to both contribute something, and they need to contribute more than sex. So they both need to make contributions, and that leads to marriage being, in the church's terms, a partnership of the whole of life that is oriented towards the procreation and education of offspring. And so God built Adam to be married, to have a partner. Now, you may also have, you know, some people who've looked at the desire for sexual union and said, oh, that reflects a desire for union with God. And okay, that I can see there's an element of truth there, but I wouldn't say that statement exhausts the reason for desire for sexual union. We also desire sexual union because God built us to. And so to have that. And so God built Adam this way, and Adam was living in accordance with Adam's nature to desire a partner in addition to God.
Okay, Emmanuel, makes sense to you?
Yeah, it does.
It was a very advanced question. I'm very impressed. Thank you for coming in. All right, on we go. Chris is in Miami, Florida, listening on the app, the Catholic Answers Live app. Glad to have you here with us, Chris. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hi, Si. Hi, Jimmy.
Hi, Chris.
Hope you guys are doing well.
Thank you.
So my question is this. it's on the validity of different Bible translations. I was discussing abortion with someone online, perhaps my first mistake, and they mentioned the Bible condones abortion, referencing Numbers 5, verses 21. Now, Jimmy, using points that you made in a video from September 2020, I explained that this wasn't the case, and I went through all the points that you made. The person then quoted word for word the verse they were referencing, and indeed it did use the wording, "May the Lord cause you to become a curse among your people when he makes your womb miscarry." I noticed this wasn't written in the Bible that I use. I use a Revised Standard Version Catholic Edition, but it is in the New International Version, the NIV. So what is the validity of this version, the NIV, and are there certain versions we shouldn't use as Catholics?
Okay, so first of all, we probably better clarify what we're talking about here. The passage you're referring to is in Numbers chapter 5, where it provides a test known as the rite of bitter water that brings a curse. For if a man begins to suspect that his wife has been unfaithful to him, there's this ritual they're supposed to do. And in the from what you're saying, in the NIV, the curse involves her womb miscarrying. But that's not what you're seeing in your, did you say Revised Standard Version Catholic Edition?
That's right.
Okay. So here's the thing. It does not clearly refer to miscarriage in the original Hebrew. When you have a question about, you know, a passage where we're not sure what it means, it's going to come out different in different Bibles, and some of them are going to make reasonable guesses, and some of them are going to make less reasonable guesses. So the translators of the New International Version, based on what you're saying, guessed that this passage means have a womb that miscarries. But that is not what it actually says in Hebrew. A literal translation of what it says is your thigh will fall. And it's not really clear what that means. And so if you read biblical commentators, they will point out that there have been a bunch of suggestions of what this might mean. It might mean that, like, for example, the ancient Jewish historian Josephus, who lived in the first century, he interpreted this because it says your belly will swell and your thigh will fall. He suggested it was dropsy, or what we today would call edema, or, you know, pathological swelling, but not miscarriage. More recent suggestions do include miscarriage, but they also include other medical conditions like thrombophlebitis and false pregnancy. So it's not really clear exactly what's going on in this passage. And, you know, the NIV interpreters have rendered it one way, and other translations render it other ways. So this is just an ambiguous text. It's just hard to be sure exactly what it means. So that then gets to your overall question, without all that as background, that gets to your overall question of, are there any translations we just shouldn't use? Well, in terms of for a specific purpose, if you know a translation has a problematic rendering of a particular passage, well, you don't want to use it in arguments that concern that passage. But the overwhelming majority of Bibles that are professionally translated these days are in the main quite fine. You know, I'm not going to say never use the NIV because it has a questionable translation in Numbers 5. You know, it's not like other translations don't have their own questionable versions of certain verses. You know, every every translation has to deal with ambiguous passages, and they're all translated by humans, and humans make mistakes and have bad choices. And so every translation has some bad passages in it. So are there translations I would say you really shouldn't use apart from really special circumstances? Well, you know, the Jehovah's Witness New World Translation comes to mind, because that one was done incompetently and with an agenda that's very strong and that contradicts what's actually in the Greek in various places. But the majority of translations are competently done. They may contain mistakes, but I wouldn't say never use them on the basis of an occasional mistake. I just say, well, be aware that, you know, any translation you're using may have some bad passages, and you need to be aware of that. And if you run across a passage that says something that seems odd, well, then you can check it out and find out, okay, is this one of those passages in this Bible? But I wouldn't say never use it. So that's what I'd have to say in general terms.
Chris, thank you. That was a Bible question. So if you'd like a copy of Jimmy's book, The Bible is a Catholic Book, we'll send that to you. Just hang on the line and Edgar will get your information. Still lines full. So off we go now to Texas. Joseph in Texas has been waiting for a while. Joseph, thank you for waiting. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
No problem. And thank you very much for taking my call. I have a moral question. From a Catholic perspective, does a what we might call successful bankruptcy filing merely forgive debt in a legal sense and not a moral sense? And then kind of the finesse on the question is, does it change your answer at all if it's, you know, like a large corporation that the debt is concerning, or if it's as personal as your parent?
Okay, so generally the civil law is presumed to reflect the moral law unless there is a specific reason to the contrary. So that's like why if civil law says you can't buy this particular thing, it's illegal to buy this, well, then you generally shouldn't unless there is a specific reason to the contrary in a particular case. So generally, the civil law and the moral law are presumed to track, except when you can show that's not the case. Now, the reason that we have bankruptcy laws is to help people out when they get into financial difficulties, because, you know, human beings sometimes get into financial difficulties, and it promotes the common good to have ways out of those difficulties. They had the equivalent of forgiveness of debts in ancient Israel. So, for example, every 7 years, debts were forgiven. So if you had an outstanding debt in ancient Israel, and the seventh year came around, that debt would get forgiven, and you didn't have to pay the person back. And so, you know, you were released from that obligation. Now, let's suppose the person that had loaned you the money, even though they now the seventh year has happened and they can't collect the money from you, let's suppose they really need it. And let's suppose that you then come in to some money and you could pay them reasonably. Well, I would say in that case, you ought to pay them not because you're legally required to, but just because they need the money and now you have the money. And it's a good and loving thing in order to repay them in that situation, even though you're not legally obligated to. And I would say the same thing applies in bankruptcy cases. Now, you mentioned, what if it's a large corporation that you owe money to? Well, you're probably not going to, they won't even have a mechanism to be able to process that. Let's say you own a house and you have a bankruptcy, and then you say, oh, and now I want to, and then you come into a windfall of money and you want to say to this giant corporation, I want to pay you that money that I used to owe but now don't. They're not going to know how to handle that. They're not, their accounting department is not set up to even process things like that. And so you may as well not bother in that case. On the other hand, you mentioned parents. So, well, I'd say that the same principles I articulated with regard to ancient Israel would apply here. Even though you're not legally obliged to pay your parents back, if they need the money and you come into the money, then I would say it's a good thing to pay them that money, even though you're no longer legally obligated to, just because you're their son and you love them, and it's a good thing to do. So if they then say, oh, no, don't bother, well, then they've released you from that. But I would say it's generally a good thing to do if they need it, and if you have it and can't afford it, then even if you don't legally owe it to them, it's still a good thing to do.
Joseph?
Yeah, so it sounds like you're saying the principle it falls on at this point is Christian charity and maybe the nature of kind of intimate relationships. So I feel like if you have an intimate relationship with someone, by nature of that intimacy, you owe them something. And it sounds like that's the kind of line of reasoning you're going with.
Well, it's not just intimate relations, although that adds to it. I mean, we should be loving to everybody. And so even if someone was not my parent, but, you know, if they need the money and I can give them the money reasonably, then it's a loving thing to do that, even if they're not my parent. But being my parent, that adds to it.
Joseph, thank you. You can hear the music. We have to take the break. Jimmy Akin is our guest. It's Ask Me Anything. Suddenly, there are a couple lines open. Three lines open, as a matter of fact. 888-318-7884. What was the church like in its infancy? In a word, Catholic. And Joe Heschmeyer has the receipts. In his best-selling book, The Early Church Was the Catholic Church, he gives you the details from the historical records of the first two centuries of Christianity. Right now, get a copy for just $10, plus free shipping if you live in the continental United States. Get more information and order The Early Church Was the Catholic Church at theearlychurchwascatholic.com.
Why We're Catholic is the one book you can hand to anyone to invite them into or back to the Catholic faith. With more than 400,000 copies sold, Trent Horn's book has had a number one ranking on Amazon.com for 5 years running. Now available in softcover, bulk cases, ebook, and on Audible. Find out what the excitement is all about. Order your copies of Why We're Catholic at shop.catholic.com or visit whywearecatholic.com.
We hope that one of the things that we communicate here at Catholic Answers Live is that our Catholic faith allows us to be fully serious about all the problems we encounter in the church and in the world, but it also lets us have light hearts and maybe even mix in a bit of fun, and that is exactly what our good friend Joe Heschmeyer does in his popular podcast, Shameless Popery. You should check it out at shamelessjoe.com. Joe's got a deep grasp of the faith, of morals, the teachings of the church, all that. But he's also got a witty conversational style. He entertains and he informs. But you will leave equipped to better answer the most common challenges, misconceptions, and questions about the Catholic faith. He's got insightful guests. He does on-air debates. And he takes a close look into all the things that you want to know about as a Catholic living today. You'll walk away knowledgeable and filled with joy. Look for Joe on his YouTube channel. Check him out at shamelessjoe.com or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like what you hear, become a patron. Digging that groovy music. There's a little bit of groovy music for you. It follows Jimmy around. He used to be on Thursdays when Jimmy was on Thursdays. Now Jimmy's here with us on Fridays and actually requested that it come, and I'm glad that kind of those two things go together, Jimmy Akin and the groovy music. Also, lots and lots of questions goes with Jimmy Akin. Lots of a great variety of questions this hour, and there's probably a chance if you would like to get in on that variety, if you call now, I'm looking at the lines, we could probably get you in by before the top of the hour, 888-318-7884. Going to head back up to Canada now. Deborah is in Ontario, Canada, watching on YouTube. Glad you're here, Deborah. Go ahead with your question.
Hello.
Hi.
My question is, with the Orthodox Jewish people, why did they not believe that Jesus is the Messiah? And how do we know that, I guess the only way I can say it is that they are making an incorrect judgment and we as Christians make the correct judgment?
Okay. Deborah, I had a little trouble hearing that. I'm not sure if you're speaking directly into the phone or if you got us on speaker. But I think I got the essence of your question, but I need to ask you a follow-up. You said Orthodox Jews. But then you used the past tense. You said didn't. And so Orthodox Judaism is a movement within Judaism. It's a specific form of modern Judaism of a type which is known as Rabbinic Judaism. It did not exist in the first century. Instead, it arose later, and it's only one of several groups. In addition to Orthodox Judaism, there's Conservative Judaism, there's Reform Judaism, and there are a few others as well. So is your question about Jewish people in general, or is it about Orthodox Jews specifically, or is it about Jews in the time of Christ? Could you give me a little extra clarity on that?
Okay. I would say Jewish people in general.
Okay. So anytime someone asks me a question of why don't group X believe thing Y, the fundamental answer is, well, you should ask them, because they're the best qualified ones to explain their reasons. I can give you some perspective, and I try to keep it as evidential as I can, because it's very easy for outsiders in particular to fall into psychological explanations for other people's beliefs rather than evidential reasons for other people's beliefs. That's not to say that there aren't psychological reasons, but I believe generally, you know, if you ask someone, why do you think this, they're not that likely to give you a psychological answer. They're more likely to try to come up with an evidential answer. And so the general, now there can be a variety of different claims that, or there can be a variety of different responses to the question you've asked. But if you ask many Jewish people, especially Jewish leaders, why do you not think Jesus is the Messiah? Probably the number one answer you're going to get is he hasn't fulfilled messianic prophecy, because the way the Messiah is understood in Judaism, he's supposed to be this ideal king of Israel who introduces a reign of peace among the nations, and they're not expecting him to die on a cross and things like that. So they would say they just don't think he fulfilled messianic prophecies the way they understand it. A Christian response to that is, well, actually, there are some passages that talk about a suffering Messiah, most notably in Isaiah 53 in the Old Testament. And then that gets us into a discussion of, does Isaiah 53 point to the Messiah? And there's actually some Jewish traditions that say, yes, it does, but not all Jewish traditions. So Jesus, according to Christians, did fulfill many of the messianic prophecies, but he hadn't fulfilled them all yet, because he fulfilled a certain number of them that dealt particularly with the suffering Messiah. And then when he comes back at the end of time, that's when he introduces the golden age in this era of peace, where he reigns personally over Israel and you know, on earth among mankind and so forth. That happens at the second coming. So he, from a Christian perspective, has fulfilled some messianic prophecies, but not yet all of the messianic prophecies. So that's a general sketch of that, of kind of the main elements in the discussion here. In terms of why would a Christian conclude that he is the Messiah? Well, he has fulfilled a bunch of messianic prophecies. Also, he rose from the dead. And we have really good evidence that he rose from the dead. The competing hypotheses just do not hold up well. And I would recommend something. I'm not sure currently what they charge for it. I don't think it's too much, but I actually did a whole video course at the Catholic Answers School of Apologetics called Evidence for Christ, where I go through all of these subjects. I talk about messianic prophecy. I talk about what Jesus has and has not fulfilled in terms of messianic prophecy, and I talk about Jesus rising from the dead and the evidence we have for that. So comprehensively, it's that course is really on point for the subject you're asking about, and I would recommend that you get a copy of that. In fact, it may even be possible for us to give you a copy of that course. I'm not sure.
I think we can. I don't want to make a promise, Deborah, but if you hang on the line, we'll get your information. And if it's possible, I think we can give out the courses. We'll get it to you. So just hang on, Deborah. We'll get your information. And if we can get you Evidence for Christ, Jimmy Akin's School of Apologetics course, we'll get it out one way or another. Jonathan is in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, watching on YouTube. Jonathan, thank you for waiting. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Yes, hi. In my psych class at university, we were given a scenario where early identification of potentially violent children sort of exists. So this would be, in this example, like psychopaths. And we were told that 60% of these children would exhibit this extreme violent behavior in society.
Okay. Jonathan, I'm having trouble understanding you. Can you speak more slowly and directly into the phone?
Yes. Can you hear me now better?
Yes.
Okay. So we were given a scenario where we were told you could identify potentially violent children, like psychopaths. And if we left these children unchecked, 60% of them would exhibit this violent behavior in society. And 40% would not. We were told, sort of asked, like, to either choose to, like, hospitalize these children, these potentially violent children, as a means to sort of protect, like, what could potentially happen, or let them be in society and, you know, let that run its course. So I was sort of wondering what could be the Catholic perspective on how to approach this question and sort of articulate a response in that regard, if that makes sense.
So did they propose an answer to this question?
Not specifically. We were just sort of, they were asking like what we individually thought would be the quote unquote appropriate response to this.
Okay. And is this a homework? I mean, is this a test question or just a class assignment?
Something where it's like a discussion question. And I was sort of thrown off the loop in class, not sure how to answer.
Okay. So, So let's strip away the irrelevant factors first. The fact that these are children is irrelevant. What we have here is a claim that we can detect a certain population that has violent tendencies. And according to the claim, 60% of the members of the population are going to do something violent in society if we don't lock them up. And give them some kind of treatment, I guess. That I believe that was part of the scenario you mentioned, because you, and then on the other hand, 40% of them won't do anything and will be safe in society. Well, in approaching this, I would say if you have, there are a whole bunch of variables here. And I think this is why this is a discussion question, because there's no clear answer. On the one hand, you need to ask, well, how reliable is this psychopathy test? You know, is it really reliable or not? I mean, today in psychology, we have the PCLR checklist that is kind of useful for detecting, you know, psychopathic traits if it's administered correctly. But not everybody who has psychopathic traits is going to max out that scale. And even among those who do have psychopathic traits, that doesn't mean they're going to be violent. There are lots of successful psychopaths who are not violent. Now, it seems like they've stipulated for purposes of this thought exercise that 60% are violent, but 60% is really close to 50%. And so I don't think that lets us have a... If we can't detect which are members of the 60% and which are members that are going to be violent and which are members of the 40% that are not going to be violent, if the options are lock them all up or let them all go, I would say this is a deliberately ambiguous situation that there's no clear answer on, because we need to know other factors like, well, how violent are they actually going to be? If they're just going to go out and be jerks and maybe get in a bar fight and punch someone, that's different than becoming mass murderers. Also, if we lock them up, do we have an effective treatment? Do we not have an effective treatment? And what are the costs of locking them up and keeping them contained? And what are the costs and harms potentially that can come from this treatment and from their dislocations, from their families and things like that? You can't just rip children away from their families because you think it's a good idea and not expect there to be costs. So I would say from a Catholic point of view, we need much more data than is presented in this question. We need to have much more knowledge about, you know, exactly how reliable is this test? How reliable are these statistics? What are the costs and benefits of taking these children away from their parents and putting them in an institution? Can we actually effectively treat them there? Are there going to be unintended negative consequences to the children and other members of society? We just need way more information than we've got. And so I would say we have a fundamentally ambiguous situation on which people could reasonably take different opinions.
And I hope that was helpful to you, Jonathan, but we are at the time for the break, so I will leave it there and come back with more questions for Jimmy. It's Ask Me Anything with Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live. Before I go to the break, I'll tell you what, we might have room for one or two more calls, so give it a shot, 888-318-7884.
There's only one, Catholic Answers Live.
The Catechism defines evangelization as the proclamation of Christ and his gospel by word and the testimony of life. But what does that look like in real life? It looks like St. Paul street evangelists out in the public square sharing the good news. We're a Catholic nonprofit that starts conversations by handing out free sacramentals. Then we employ our method of listen, befriend, proclaim, and invite. Catholic Answers is supported in part by St. Paul Street Evangelization. Visit streetevangelization.com to learn more.
The wisdom of Mother Angelica.
I told him about the woman who came to me and said her two children hadn't spoken to each other for 2 years. Their grandma died and she was very wealthy. She left half to each one. She said they're arguing over a commode. She said it's inlaid. Can you imagine being in hell and somebody saying to you, what are you here for?
EWTN. Live truth. Live Catholic.
Jimmy Akin, our guest, and it's Ask Me Anything. I'm Cy Kellett, your host, Catholic Answers Live. Hey, Jubilee Year starts. I've been trying to mention it every day. Jubilee Year starts on Christmas Eve. If you want to know about it, there are lots of websites dedicated to it. You can check out the Vatican website. They've got information on it. Big Jubilee Year every 25 years in the Catholic Church, and every now and then a bonus one in between, but the every 25-year one, we're pretty we stick to those. So if you want to find out about it, do find out about it. The internet is full of information on it. Next call for Jimmy is coming from Oklahoma. Mary is in Oklahoma. Mary, thank you very much for the call. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hi. Yes. I'm also apologizing in advance. I ask questions horribly, but is there anything in the Bible or anywhere in the Bible that mentions like mother-in-laws and father-in-laws and kind of like what kind of relationships like us as married people are supposed to have with our in-laws?
How long you been married, Mary?
only a small 4 years.
Okay. All right. All right. Well, let's get you an answer. Sorry, Jimmy.
Yeah. And I don't know why you say you ask questions horribly, because that was perfectly intelligible.
Yeah.
So there are mentions of in-laws, but there aren't really rules that are applied. Now, in ancient Israel, their society was a little different than ours because it was organized along patriarchal lines. And so if you're a male, you're always a member of your father's house. And if you're a female, when you marry someone, you become a member of your husband's house. So your primary allegiance goes to them. So even though you have love and relations with your biological parents in your own house of origin, your primary responsibility is now to the house of your husband, which is the house of his fathers, you know, his line in the tribe. But that's their culture. That's not our culture. And it doesn't, in our culture, it's much more egalitarian. Now, women do commonly take the name of their husband, but they don't view themselves as, now my primary allegiance is with my husband's family rather than my family of origin. That was a cultural matter that doesn't really apply in our circumstance. Even in the ancient world, though, it was acknowledged a woman still has a relationship with her family of origin, but she's also supposed to, you know, be a loving and loyal stepdaughter to the family, or daughter-in-law to the family that she's married into. And the same general principles are going to apply here. You want to get along with both your family of origin and your in-laws to the extent possible. Now, because we're not a patriarchal culture, you're not really under the authority of the older generation, the way people were in extended families, where you kind of need to listen to the family patriarch and obey his orders under ordinary circumstances. Today, you don't really got to listen to your grandfather, whether you're a male or, you know, if you're a male, you don't really got to, your grandfather doesn't really give you orders. And in the same way, if you're married to a husband, you don't really got to listen to your husband's grandfather give you orders, because we're not living in extended families that are multi-generational like this. So I would say just the principles that do apply from their culture to ours are, in general, you know, love your neighbor. You want to love your in-laws to the best of your ability. Since they're family, since they're close, you want to do what you can for them. You want to help folks get along, but that doesn't mean you gotta, you know, slavishly cater to their every whim.
I think I'll come back to you. Make sure that we got to what you wanted, Mary. Is that all clear?
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense, actually. Thank you.
All right. You're very welcome. Thank you for the call. I'm going to come back here to California. Aiden is here in California. Aiden, go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hello, Jimmy. For Our Lady of Fatima's peace plan, does she want us to be enrolled in a scapular by a priest? I'm confused with what exactly a part of the peace plan.
Well, to tell you the truth, I am too, because I hear a lot of people making claims about Mary's peace plan and stuff like that. And I would have to do research into the primary source documents. And I actually have the primary source documents. I suspect that a lot of what gets claimed may not be that reliable, because people have a tendency to exaggerate and build in things that are really more their own personal preferences. And also, even though Fatima is an approved apparition, that doesn't mean everything in it is exactly the will of heaven. Also, the primary period that Fatima applied to was the Cold War. And when the Soviet, and, you know, John Paul II acknowledged that after the Soviet Union fell apart, the principal era that Fatima applied to was in the past. So to the extent there was a Fatima peace plan, it applied to peace in the Cold War. And that's over. Now, there can always be a new Cold War. We can always also take principles from, you know, things Mary apparently counseled at Fatima and apply them today, but we're applying them to a fundamentally new situation. And so we're kind of doing that. If we do that, we're doing that in hope that it'll have a positive effect today. And it may well, but we don't have a promise. And so I would say that we shouldn't get overly scrupulous in this area, because there are a bunch of uncertainties, and we just want to try to be good people and pray to God for peace and do what we can to promote peace in the world. But we shouldn't look at certain things like wearing a scapular as if it's magic and it's, oh, if I wear a scapular, it's going to cause peace in the world. Well, you know, that's unlikely. I mean, maybe it will, but it's kind of unlikely. So I would say don't be overly scrupulous in this area.
Aiden, thank you. I hope that answer was helpful to you. Going to keep going, try to get as many as I can on. Alan is in Tucson, Arizona. Welcome, Alan. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Yeah, hi. Not that long ago, we were at a rosary group at church, and the leader indicated that the devil could steal souls from purgatory. Is that true?
Not in the Catholic understanding of purgatory. In the Catholic understanding of purgatory, everyone who goes to purgatory goes to heaven. Purgatory is simply a sort of antechamber to heaven where they clean you up so that you're ready to be in heaven. And once you die in God's friendship, your salvation is secure. And if you're in the process of getting cleaned up, the devil has no ability to make your salvation unsecure. So whoever this person was that said this, they, if that's what they said, they were not articulating the Catholic Church's understanding, but their own idea.
That's what I thought, too. I thought, that's my impression of what I've read so far. But I thought, this calls someone and get an answer. So
I'm glad you did, Alan. Thank you. Alan, tell you what, we have a book on purgatory. Purgatory is for Real by our colleague Carlo Broussard. And if you'd like a copy of it, I will be happy to send it out to you. Just hang on and we'll get an address to send it to. Thanks, Alan. Davis is in New England. Welcome, Davis. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Yeah. So the rumor is that the next Archbishop of Canterbury is going to be a woman bishop. If the next Archbishop of Canterbury Church of England is a woman, would that mean that the Church of England has apostatized and that the Catholic Church should end ecumenical dialogue with the Church of England?
No, it would not mean that the Anglican Church has apostatized, because apostasy is the complete repudiation of the Christian faith. It's way worse than heresy. It's way worse than any other form of religious error. It's where you say, I am no longer a Christian. If you maintain any kind of Christian identity, you have not apostatized. And so if they do have a female Archbishop of Canterbury, that's a mistake. But it's not the only mistake the Anglican Church has made, and it is not equal to apostasy.
Tell you what, I'm going to try to get another one on. So I hope that was helpful. Thank you very much for the question. Let's go to Ted in Denver, Colorado. I'll tell you what, Ted, if you could please ask your question quickly, that will give Jimmy a chance to answer it.
Yes, sir. Why do us Catholics honor the Sabbath day on Sunday?
Well, that was quick. Thank you, Ted.
Well, we don't. We honor the principle of having a day for rest and worship on Sunday rather than on Saturday, which is the Sabbath. But so we honor the principle, but the Sabbath, the Jewish Sabbath, it's always been Saturday, and Sunday is not the Sabbath, even though you hear some people use that language. What Sunday is the Lord's Day. So the reason we honor the Lord's Day and not Saturday is because we're not bound by the law of Moses, which commands Saturday as a day of rest and worship. So we're just not bound by that. But Jesus rose from the dead. The Lord Jesus rose from the dead on Sunday. And so we celebrate the Lord's Day instead. And that's a tradition that goes all the way back to the first century. And we see the apostles like St. Paul doing that. You know, he talks about how collections for the poor should be taken up on the first day of the week, on Sunday, when Christians are meeting together collectively. And so we know that Christian worship on Sunday goes all the way back to the first century, and the reason is because that's the day on which our Lord Jesus rose from the dead.
Ted, that all makes sense to you?
Yes, it does. I just need to know the exact spelling of your last name, Jimmy.
It's really easy. It's just like it sounds. My last name is Akin, and so it's spelled A-K-I-N. There are no E's, T's, or S's. It's just four letters, Akin, A-K-I-N.
Ted, thank you. Often I ask people at the end of the show, will you please get to your question quickly? And
you did.
They don't. They don't. But you did, Ted. What book can we give Ted to say thank you for being quick when we asked him to be quick?
A Daily Defense.
Let's give him yes. Those are one-page answers. A Daily Defense, 365 days plus one to becoming a better apologist. Jimmy Akin's book, perfect for a guy who can get right to his question because Jimmy can get right to his answer in those books. Jimmy, thanks very much. Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. New episode drops each Friday. And today's episode, it was just there.
Exorcism.
Oh, yeah, exorcisms. Look, everybody's talking about exorcisms. You know you want to know what Jimmy Akin has to say about all this. Check it out. He looks at the rites of exorcisms to uncover the truth about exorcism, because there's all kinds of stuff out there right now. Also, check out the Jimmy Akin podcast and a lot of other things from Jimmy on his YouTube page or wherever you get your podcasts. Jimmy, thank you very much. I always enjoy doing 2 hours with you.
Likewise.
And that will do it for us here at Catholic Answers. What a great week. Enjoy. Oh, well, we're getting closer and closer. Don't forget, the Jubilee year starts Christmas Eve. And then Christmas season starts also Christmas Eve. We'll be back Monday to do it again. Thanks. We'll see you then, God willing, on Catholic Answers Live.